In the Old Testament, a very common occurrence was to meet your future bride at the well. I note the frequency with which this type of incident happens in the Old Testament, quite commonly in some of my classes at school. And I keep telling the guys that's where you went to pick up girls, because in every city, the well, of course, would not be inside the city, it would be outside. And typically, that's where the young ladies would be sent to draw the water. That was a work that was, while not to my knowledge exclusive to the young ladies, was nevertheless a quite characteristic task for young daughters in family. And that would be one circumstance where they would be kind of out in public, and where it might even be, I suppose, socially acceptable to talk to them as well. And, of course, the well is not just the place where the young girls would go out to draw water and take back into the house in the city. It's also the place where kind of everybody would show up, and especially people that were coming to town from a distance. It would often be that the road to a town would be arranged so that it would run by the well, because anybody coming into town, first thing they would want would be to stop and get some water, to replenish their own water containers, to water their animals, and so forth. And so this particular structure, the well, typically outside the city, typically near a gate of the city, typically near the place where the main roads would be going by. And it was just a place where people showed up. In that part of the world especially, everybody shows up where there's water. And so Moses meets his wife-to-be, Zipporah, at the well. Jacob meets Rachel, of course, at the well. And in the case of Isaac, it's not Isaac himself, but his father's servant who has been sent on his behalf, who meets Rebekah at the well. And so I tell the guys at school all the time, that's where you went to pick up girls, was at the well. And I suspect that there probably were some kind of social feelings about that. But I want to look at one particular case just for a moment. In Genesis chapter 24, there is the account here of Abraham's servant who has been sent a great distance in this case, from the land of Canaan all the way back to the land of Haran, a distance of several hundred miles, with a camel caravan, no less, to go to the city of Nahor, the city named Haran, where Abraham's brother Nahor and his part of the family live, and to find a young girl, to find a wife for Isaac, the son of Abraham. And when he got there in the evening, and sure enough, comes to the well. In verse 11, it says he made the camels kneel down outside the city by the well of water at eventime, the time when women go out to draw water. And he offers a prayer that God might show him the way, as it were, to find the appropriate young girl to be the wife for his master's son. And his prayer is, in verse 14, "Now may it be that the girl to whom I say, please let down your jar so that I may drink, and who answers, drink and I will water your camels also, may she be the one whom thou hast appointed for thy servant Isaac." That was to be the test. Not just that she would give him a drink if he asked, I suppose anybody might be expected to do that, but if she would volunteer further to draw water for the camel caravan that's behind him that he's brought of 10 camels, then that would be the one. And in verse 15, it says, "It came about before he had finished speaking, that behold, Rebekah, who was born to Bethuel, the son of Milcah, the wife of Abraham's brother Nahor, came out with her jar on her shoulder. And the girl was very beautiful, a virgin, and no man had had relations with her. And she went down to the spring and filled her jar and came up. Then the servant ran to meet her and said, please let me drink a little water from your jar. And she said, drink, my lord. And she quickly lowered her jar to her hand and gave him a drink. And when she had finished giving him a drink, she said, I will draw also for your camels until they have finished drinking. So she quickly emptied her jar into the trough and ran back to the well to draw, and she drew for all his camels, which no doubt would have taken some time. And in verse 21 it says, "Meanwhile the man was gazing at her in silence to know whether the Lord had made his journey successful or not." This, of course, is just what he had asked for, and it seems to beat all expectations, all of his wildest hopes that it would be so easy. You just come up to the city, and there the girl shows up immediately. And it came about in verse 22 when the camels had finished drinking, and he's had plenty of time to think about it now. This must be the Lord's answer. The man took a gold ring weighing a half shekel and two bracelets from her wrist, weighing 10 shekels in gold, or for her wrist weighing 10 shekels in gold, and said, "Whose daughter are you? Please tell me, is there room for us to lodge in your father's house?" And she said to him, "I am the daughter of Bethuel, the son of Milcah, whom she bore to Nahor." And of course, his very charge had been to go back and find the family, to find Nahor's branch of the family. And lo and behold, this woman, who seems clearly to be the answer to his prayer, now identifies herself as the granddaughter, as it is, of Nahor here. And she said to him, "We have plenty of both straw and feed and room to lodge in." And then the man bowed low and worshiped the Lord. No doubt he saw, of course, that this had worked out just, beyond the best possible expectations. As I say, this is a common theme in the Old Testament, to go and meet the woman at the well. But there's another story of another man meeting a very different woman at the well that I want us to turn our attention to now. In the Gospel of John, the 4th chapter, passage we were reading from just a few moments ago, I start by looking at the case of Rebekah, and maybe we could have looked at Rachel. We know a little bit less about the circumstances of Moses and Zipporah, but all of those are sort of romantic times, happy times. At least a couple of occasions, we're told that the woman that showed up was beautiful. Rebekah was beautiful, and she was a virgin. Rachel, we're told when she shows up at the well, she is fair of face and fair of form. We are told. We're not told that Zipporah was beautiful, but I suppose she probably was, at least to Moses. But this is a different story. There's no romance here at all. In the Gospel of John, chapter 4, starting once again in verse 4, says, "And he had to pass through Samaria." Interesting that the word "had to pass," it was necessary. King James Version says something like, "He must needs pass through Samaria." The truth is, most Jews didn't see it a necessity to go through Samaria to get from Judea to Galilee. Most, if they saw any necessity about the matter at all, saw the necessity of avoiding going through Samaria, and frequently would go down and take the river road to circumvent going through the territory of Samaria. I don't know just why it was that Jesus had to go through Samaria, whether he was in such a hurry to get back through to Galilee that the more direct route seemed necessary, or whether, as I suspect, the must go through Samaria or had to go through Samaria had something to do with his very purpose in taking the gospel to the Samaritans and showing that it was for them as well. Seems to me that that would be more consistent with what our Lord would perceive as a necessity in this particular circumstance. But he came to a city of Samaria called Sychar, near the parcel of ground that Jacob gave to his son Joseph. And Jacob's well was there. Interestingly, Jacob, who had met Rachel at the well. Of course, this wasn't the well where he met her. This was a well he had dug when he had returned to Palestine after he had married Rachel and Leah and had his 11 of what would eventually be his 12 sons. He had come to this area and dug this particular well. But here, sitting by that well, Jesus, being wearied from his journey, says, was sitting thus by the well, just kind of sat down as a tired man would. And it was about the 6th hour. We're not real certain whether that 6th hour was noon, as some have argued, or whether it was in the late evening. Basically, the question is John referring to Roman time, or is he referring to time as the Jews typically counted, reckoning the hours of the day from morning instead of from noon? At any rate, verse 7, he meets a woman at the well too. There came a woman of Samaria to draw water. And Jesus, as Abraham's servant had done, says, "Give me a drink." For his disciples had gone away into the city to buy food. Rebecca, as you may recall, had not only given a drink, but volunteered to draw water for the whole camel caravan. This woman's response is a little different. "Oh, I suppose she gave him a drink." But with these words, "How is it that you, being a Jew, ask me for a drink, since I am a Samaritan woman?" And John's little note to us, for Jews have no dealings with Samaritans. Oh, they could have some financial dealings, as indicated by the fact that the disciples had gone to town to buy bread. I mean, in one sense, they had dealings. But they just didn't associate with each other, not in any real and meaningful way. And yet Jesus asked her for a drink. Probably hard for us to appreciate the significance of the fact that he asked her for a drink. I might say, well, on the one hand, surely anybody would ask for a drink, but Jesus doesn't have a bucket. He doesn't have anything to draw water, to handle water with, as will be pointed out. That means he's going to be drinking from that Samaritan woman's vessel. And to a Jew, that would probably be a thing that most Jews would have considered pretty offensive. But I want to think about this woman for a moment. And I think what a difference between her and Rebecca. When we meet Rebecca back there in Genesis chapter 24, she is beautiful, a beauty that apparently had just blossomed in that young woman. She was a virgin and had all of the beauty that associates with that pure virginity of the young girl. But this woman that Jesus meets at the well, maybe at one time she had been beautiful. Maybe too beautiful for her own good, I don't know. But whatever beauty she had once had long faded. She is a woman that probably had rather deeply furrowed brow and a lot of wrinkles, not just perhaps around her eyes and the corners of her mouth, but maybe even in a lot of other places too. She's a woman that in many ways was worn out with life. She is not a virgin. She is, as we learn just a little bit later, a woman who has already had five husbands and is presently living with somebody that is not her husband. And if Rebecca is sort of the ideal of the type of woman that you might expect to meet at the well, she's probably everything you'd be afraid you might meet at the well. Indeed, in the Song of Solomon, man there describes the beautiful woman as a well of living water. And Rebecca was that. This woman's not. In fact, it's interesting, she's come to the well. There were two words in the Greek New Testament commonly used for a well. And there was one that meant really something much more like a cistern or a pit. And the water that was in that well tended to be stagnant, probably a bit fetid. Not your best water, but adequate in a pinch. But then there was another word that meant a fountain, really. Something it suggested fresh water, living water. Not necessarily from an open spring on a hillside, as we might think of, but it would suggest a well that was not just a reservoir, a cistern collecting runoff rainwater and holding it in a trap, but there was actually fresh water flowing underground there that you had tapped into. And of course, that would be the very best type of water. And throughout this whole chapter, Jesus will constantly talk about water as a fountain, using that word. She never does. To her, it's always just a well. That is, that suggestion of stagnant water. And I think in some ways her repeated insistence and choice on that word is a reflection of her outlook on life. There's also a difference, as intimated just a moment ago. When Rebecca was asked for a drink, she says, drink and your camels too. When this woman is asked for a drink, her response is more or less, what are you doing asking me for a drink? And when, of course, Abraham's servant inquires as to Rebecca and who she is, we discover, hey, she's part of the family. She's part of our group. And we learn her name. I'm Rebecca. And she says, I'm the descendant of Nahor. We know who she is. She belongs to our people. This woman, we never even learn her name. She's a Samaritan. She's those other people that we don't have anything to do with, that don't have anything to do with us. Now, you think about it for a minute. Maybe in talking about meeting the woman at the well, I think especially of men, but I'm sure those girls went out there to the well sometimes wondering what type of man might show up there too. But I ask you, which of the two would you rather meet at the well? Rebecca or this nameless Samaritan woman? The pure young virgin who's ready to do anything to help? Or this worn out lady who just wants to know why you bother her to ask her for a drink? Rebecca's the story too good to be true. Most of you guys wouldn't admit it, but it's every guy's fantasy. Maybe you don't think about the well, but you know, you think, is this the day I'm going to drive past a car with this beautiful girl with a flat tire that I help and fall in love? She falls in love with me because I help her, you know, or something like that. She's the type that maybe once in your life, if you're lucky, you'll be able to meet and marry her. But the woman Jesus meets at the well, the Samaritan woman, she's everywhere. She's in every checkout line in the grocery store. She's the woman you really meet at the laundromat rather than the one they always show you meeting in the movies. What type of woman is she? She didn't have much hope left. There was a sports announcer a few years ago named Kurt Gowdy who was famous for making dumb statements. And one of his statements about a young baseball player was his future was mostly ahead of him. And somebody asked what that really meant, to say his future was mostly ahead of him. Well, to pick up on that, this lady's future was all behind her. And even if it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to say it that way, logically, I think we do in fact understand what that means. I suspect, as I indicated earlier, that she was once beautiful. But she'd apparently made some bad choices and paid a very heavy price. We speculate, maybe assume too much, about who it was and how she'd gotten to be in this situation. If I were going to guess, I suppose maybe she was the type of woman who was always attracted to the wrong type of man. Thought she wanted a man who would love her, but was sure it would be the most handsome fellow or something of that nature, or the richest fellow, but always attracted to the wrong type of man. Might not have been exactly that. Maybe she was one of those people that was just dependent and desperate, and she would marry anybody who would have her because she didn't know how to get along in life otherwise, and then find herself constantly cast off. Or maybe she had left them. Maybe she was the one who was the unreliable, the morally broken. The fact that she's currently living with somebody that's not her husband might suggest that to us. Maybe all of her earlier husbands had died. You know, I don't suppose we could prove that she didn't have what we might call a scriptural divorce or death for every single one of them. I doubt that. But even if so, that wasn't an easy life. In any case, whether the worst or best construction we can put on her situation, this is a woman that I'm sure was but a shell of what she had once been. Here she is, she's working to survive. Seems to have a sort of a day-to-day existence. She doesn't have any children. She doesn't have any daughters to send out to the well to draw for herself, apparently, to draw for her. I suppose most ladies that had had five husbands, they would at least be of sufficient station in life that, you know, now they got somebody to draw water for them, but not her. She's suspicious. Here's this fellow comes up and says, "Give me a drink." She's suspicious, especially of those who offer something good. She's a bit sharp-tongued. I mean, when Jesus says, "Can I have a drink of water? Give me a drink." Again, some people say she never did give him a drink. Well, it's true. We're not told that she didn't give that she gave him a drink, but I can't imagine that she didn't. But apparently, it comes with this: "How is it that you, being a Jew, ask me a drink, since I am a Samaritan woman?" Both the fact that she was a Samaritan and the fact that she was a woman might suggest, you know, why would you be talking to me? I think she probably said that pretty sharply. I don't think she's just asking, sort of, "Boy, that was a kind of curious thing to me. How is it that you're doing this?" I suspect it's kind of like, you know, "You Jews, yeah, you're pretty high and mighty, and you look down on us Samaritans until we got to water, and you don't, and then suddenly you know." You get real nice to me here. Probably been a lot of men who had been real nice to her when they wanted something from her before. And in fact, I think she's probably pretty sharp-tongued throughout this until we get down later on. Say more about that in just a moment. She's also a woman who is a bit ashamed of her past. Not interested in talking about her personal life, as we'll see when Jesus gets down and starts talking to her about her husbands. She changes the subject immediately. Probably especially not interested in talking about her personal life with this strange Jewish man that showed up. I doubt she was practicing religion, but she knows some of the issues. When Jesus does talk to her about her five husbands and presently living with somebody that's not, she says, "Well, I perceive you're a prophet." And then she says, "Our fathers worshipped in this mountain. You say that in Jerusalem's a place where men ought to worship." She kind of knows some good questions to ask right there. It's kind of like the person who may not be very much involved in religion, but they know to ask you, "You think you're the only ones going to heaven?" Or, "What about the thief on the cross?" Or, "Why don't you use a piano?" You know, something like that. It's always got a good diversionary kind of intimidating question to ask to deflect the issue. And I ask, do we see this woman as a likely candidate for Jesus to talk to? Contrast her with Nicodemus. Third chapter of the Gospel of John tells about Nicodemus who came to Jesus. You could talk about her not only in contrast to Rebecca, but in contrast to Nicodemus. I mean, Nicodemus here was a godly Jewish man, an observant, law-abiding Jew, already interested in Jesus. He comes to Jesus. He seeks Jesus out. He's Jewish. He's a man. I mean, everything this woman wasn't, Nicodemus was. And it's not surprising to us that Jesus talks to Nicodemus. But when you put this woman beside Nicodemus, is this the type of person that Jesus is interested in? Jesus still talked to her. Indeed, Nicodemus sought Jesus out. Jesus is the one who seeks this woman out, who makes the point of opening up the conversation to her. I'll tell you something else. Before it's over, Jesus will tell her something he never told Nicodemus. He will tell her something that up to this point he had not told his disciples, that he was in fact the Messiah. This woman. This woman, I suggest, is not someone odd and different. This Samaritan woman is the world in need of salvation. She is a far better representative of the type of people that we need to think about taking the gospel to. We're ready to convert the Nicodemuses of the world. And we're ready to convert the Rebekahs of the world too. But despite the somewhat unbalanced appearance, I always think about that, Rebecca, meeting women at the well. You guys down here, you got it great. You can meet the women at the church here. You know, you can come here and you got all these attractive young ladies. But that's not the way most of the world is. World's mostly full of Samaritan women, not Rebekahs, and not Nicodemuses. And they are people in need of hope, in need of living water. Let's ask, what did she see in Jesus? I mean, the first thing she saw was a Jew. And I'm sure she assumed he'll be condescending and arrogant like all the rest of them are. Next thing she sees, he's a man. I think this is probably a woman who knows, I know what men want. And she probably expected much the same from Jesus. But she's surprised when he asks her for water. Maybe there is a bit of that sort of bitter satisfaction. You Jews despise us all right till you're thirsty and we've got the water bucket. Frankly, I think she probably thought at first that Jesus was a sort of a loony after he began talking to her about the living water. Look at the text here momentarily again. John chapter 4, Jesus asks her for water. And she responds in verse 9, "How is it that you, being a Jew, ask me for a drink since I am a Samaritan woman?" And verse 10, Jesus answered and said to her, "If you knew the gift of God and who it is who says to you, 'Give me a drink,' you would have asked him and he would have given you living water." Now, a lot of people assume that just as soon as Jesus said that, you know, she suddenly began to think, oh, this is a different sort of man who may tell me how to be saved or something. You read most of the commentaries that say that. I try to think about that. I mean, this woman's had five husbands. She's living with somebody that's not. And this guy comes in off the road, this sort of strange Jew, and he's sitting there and he says, "Well, if you knew who I was, you'd ask me and I'd give you living water." I don't think a worldly, wise, hardened woman would likely have been softened quite that easily. I suspect that her response here is really probably delivered in a bit of a sort of a tart tone of voice. When she says to him in verse 11, "Sir, you've got nothing to draw and the well is deep. Where do you get that living water?" It's kind of like, I keep talking to you. Where are you going to get this living water? You don't even have a bucket here. Verse 12, "You are not greater than our father Jacob, are you, who gave us this well and drank of it himself and his sons and his cattle? Who do you think you are?" But Jesus persists and said to her, "Everybody who drinks of this water here that you're drawing shall thirst again. But whoever drinks of the water that I shall give him shall never thirst. But the water that I shall give him shall become in him a well of water springing up to eternal life." Weighty words, if you believe you're talking to Jesus, the Son of God. But I don't believe at this point she's got any reason to believe she's talking to Jesus, the Son of God. Now, what do you think about somebody who says this type of thing? Oh, I can give you some water, and you drink of this, and you'll never have to take another drink. And when the woman says in verse 15, "Sir, give me this water so I will not be thirsty nor come all the way here to draw." Again, I'd really kind of like to know the tone of voice because, as I say, most people assume that she's seriously asking for the water right here. I kind of suspect that she's saying, "Oh, I'd like to have some of that. Why don't you give me some of that? I'd like to not have to come out here." But with pretty much a sense of who is this guy? But then Jesus shifts the subject entirely. And we'll pick up with that once again in just a moment. My point is that I think probably she first thought this fellow sitting here talking to her, she doesn't even know who he is. If she's heard of Jesus of Nazareth, she doesn't know this is Jesus. Talking to her about water that you drink it, that you don't ever have to drink anymore again. But I would say this, that even so, in her burned out life, I think she could still wish there was such a thing. That she could wish that there would be some water that would really slake the thirst, not just of her mouth and body, but of her heart and soul. She too could somewhere deep inside long for a fountain free for her burned out, dried up life. There are many people who have no objective hope. We have an objective hope. When we say we have the hope of heaven, we don't mean we get to wish we might go to heaven. We mean that we have a reason to expect that we are going to go to heaven because we believed the promises of God. There are a lot of people in the world that don't have hope in that sense, but everybody in this world has got a subjective hope. I could wish for something better. Somehow things ought to be better than what I've had. But then Jesus tells her to go get her husband. Apparently an embarrassing moment. She does have a conscience, this woman. You might say, what would she care? She might say, what do you care? But apparently she did care. She cared at least enough to evade. Now, she doesn't exactly lie. She says, I don't have a husband. Well, she didn't. He says, that's right, you don't. She says, fact of the matter is, he says to her, you've had five husbands. And the fellow you're living with now is not your husband. It's almost like here this fellow that she had at first thought was such, maybe even a nut, suddenly knows all about her. And remember, this is before, you know, our modern electronic age when Jesus could have, called the credit, company and gotten information about her or something. This is when people lived in tight-knit little villages and you knew everybody in the village and everybody in the village knew you and everything about you. But outside of that, people weren't known. And here's this fellow who comes in out of nowhere from a totally different world and he knows everything about her. And I think at this point she is deeply transformed and yet frustrated too. She says, I perceive you're a prophet. But she didn't want to talk about her husbands anymore. She wants to change the subject. And Jesus lets her change the subject, but uses that too. But I want to suggest that her perspective has changed. And it's not changed just because Jesus knows everything about her. To me, the great power of this incident and the power that Jesus has to arrest her attention and her heart now is not just that he says, I know things about you that you wouldn't have thought I knew, but the fact that even though he knows that, he still cares about her. Because suddenly now she realizes, this fellow who knew I had five husbands and was living with somebody that wasn't my husband, this Jew. And they're usually so condescending to us Samaritans, so standoffish from us Samaritans. He not only knows I'm a Samaritan, he knows all these things about me. And he's still talking to me about whatever he meant by that living water. And he keeps on talking to me. He cares about me. I don't think she's used to that. Much less from a Jew who knew everything about her. A man who seemed to know who she was, really was, and still care about her. Something she had never met before. I wonder if perhaps that may not have been what prompted her to talk about the coming Messiah. She says, I know a Messiah is coming. Maybe it was just the fact that Jesus was talking about some new age when he says the hour is coming and now is when true worshipers shall worship the Father in spirit and truth. Is the Messiah going to be the one that brings that, she asked. But I think perhaps there was a deeper inner response. I've never met a man like this before. She probably met a lot of men at the well. Probably been men at the well looking in earlier years for a woman like her. But she's never met any man like this. And she left her water jar. We're never told exactly, in so many words, what she felt in her heart. But we're told she left her water jar and went back to town. She was moved. And she went back to town and started talking to them about this fellow who knew everything about her, and asking them. Oh, granted, she asked in a way that it's not too committal, but the mere fact that she says, do you think this could be the Messiah? Actually, what she says is, you don't think this could be the Messiah? But you know how people sometimes ask a question like that when they just don't want to look quite too foolish, but they do want to tell you what's been on their mind. Abraham's servant, saw Rebekah as meeting his needs and Isaac's needs. Jesus saw the Samaritan woman and her needs. And I want to bring the lesson to a conclusion this morning. There are all kinds of things that we could talk about in context here. But I want to bring the lesson to a conclusion this morning by thinking about the implications of this for evangelism. The Nicodemuses of this world may seek us out, as Nicodemus sought Jesus out. But we will have to seek out the woman at the well. But I want you to note her success. Nicodemus went back and couldn't even tell the rest of the Pharisees, the rest of his social group, about Jesus. And if he had, they would have mocked him. This one goes back and tells her town, and they come out in mass to hear Jesus. You want to know who the most effective inviters are to get people to come to church? It's not people like Nicodemus. It's people like this woman. Because they saw that something had affected her. And they went to see what it could possibly be. And when they came out, those are the very people, we all know the statement, we sing about it, the fields are white unto harvest. When Jesus made that statement, it was talking to his disciples about all those people who'd come out to see him when she went back to town and said, this can't be the Christ, is it? Verse 30 says, they went out of the city and were coming to him. And in verse 35, do you not say there are yet 4 months and then comes the harvest? Behold, I say to you, lift up your eyes and look on the fields. They are white for harvest. Ask a question this morning. Do you know a Samaritan woman? Ask her for a drink of water. And tell her about Jesus and the woman he met at the well. In just a moment, we're going to stand and sing our song of invitation. It might be that someone here this morning realizes their need for Jesus and the fountain of living water. Maybe identifies more with this woman in some way or other in the need for that which can truly be the water of life. Or it may be that there's someone here that, having wandered away, needs the prayers, perhaps even the forgiveness of their brethren, or wants to ask brethren pray with them before God. In any case, if you're subject to the invitation, we extend it now as we stand and sing together.